Good morning. This is John MacArthur here at Bookubon headquarters. Today is Tuesday, August 7th, and I'm here with my co-host, Stu Miniman, and we are going to be discussing building a enterprise scalability in a shared infrastructure. We have as our guest today, Luke Norris, who's the CEO of Peak Tolo. Luke, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Just go through a couple of logistics here before we get started. If you have questions, you can direct message them on Twitter to @Wikibon. Also, we'll open up questions to the audience periodically throughout today's call. Today's call is being recorded, and it is also streaming live on SiliconANGLE TV, so siliconangle.tv. If you're not speaking, please mute your phone. Star 6 mutes your phone, and you can unmute it to ask a question. Press star 6 again. So if you just take a moment now and mute your phones, that would be great. And with that, Luke, I'd like to turn it over to you for a second here. And first, tell us a little bit about Peak Tolo and what you do.
Sure, thank you. Peak Tolo is an infrastructure as a service organization. We founded in 2006. We really see it as the building blocks of cloud. And if you build off of a strong foundation and infrastructure, then PaaS providers, SaaS providers, are people that are generally looking to get into cloud services can white label and build on top of ours. We're a 100% channel-driven organization with the majority of our business coming from that white label model where people are taking our base infrastructure and building their unique service offerings on top of it. We have 5 data centers right now in the continental United States, 1 overseas, and we're rapidly expanding.
How fast are you growing?
Year over year, well over 300% right now.
Okay, so that creates some interesting challenges for you. Grow that fast to support
The technical challenges are daily, and when you try to build foundational infrastructure, components that can meet 100% SLA and also meet any demands, the infrastructure truly has to be able to accept the smallest loads to the highest peak loads. So when you look at that and how to build that out in a continuous, non-disruptive manner, it's a constant architectural challenge to scale.
When you started Peak Tolo, what was the networking infrastructure that you went with at that time?
We had a plethora of vendors. We're probably on our 5th iteration of our infrastructure product. We've had vendors from Dell, Cisco Systems, Extreme Networks, you name it. And only recently, in the last, say, 12 to 13 months, we actually consolidated down to one vendor, and that was Brocade.
What was the reason for the consolidation?
The driving factor for the consolidation was we were consistently running into speed throughput issues and spanning tree issues on our rapid expansion. The ability to plug in a switch midday and feel 100% comfortable that you're not going to hit that scale point that causes a spanning tree issue was paramount for us. So we actually started looking at fabric-based solutions, particularly based on the Trill protocol, replacing spanning tree altogether. And at the time, the Brocade VDX switch line was the only line that came remotely close to giving us what we needed.
So Luke, Trill's, relatively new. I was just reading an article today actually talking about how while the standards are pretty much in shape, nobody's building off of just standards-based Trill. You've got Cisco with that. Somebody's got a computer on or something that's getting a little bit of an echo. If you're not talking, make sure you hit star 6 to mute. If you've got a computer on and a phone, please mute the computer. Sorry about that, Luke. So I guess what attracted you to Trill, since it is relatively early in the maturity of that, and how did you make your decision to choose Brocade VCS?
So we did a pretty comprehensive comparison between all the vendors out there. And one thing that I was extremely excited about is since we were looking to go to a completely converged network on the 10 gigabit infrastructure, I actually flew out to many of the headquarters, and the time I spent working with Brocade and understanding that they had finally collapsed the Ethernet level componentry to the resiliency and feature sets that they had always had in their fiber channel, the whole regression testing, the capabilities to deliver a single unified fabric, they really sort of validated my comfort level in picking them as a one solid solution.
Okay, and you were familiar with Brocade on the fiber channel side before, and you know what is your new environment need to your fiber channel?
Yes, we're obviously very, very familiar with Brocade on the fiber channel. They've owned the market, and you know the slogan with other many vendors is you never got fired going fiber channel, especially with Brocade. But as an infrastructure component to adapt and scale at the rate and speed we needed to, NFS and iSCSI were really going to be the protocols of choice, mainly because we're NetApp backend on our cluster mode technology. So everything had to be IP driven. Due to that, essentially we completely have ripped out all fiber channel components and have this completely converged, collapsed 10 gig infrastructure on the Brocade VDX switch line.
One of the things that sort of always was the underpinnings of storage networking was it was important to separate the server network from the storage network because of the differences in workload and sort of the different approaches to management. How has it been to bring them back together?
Luckily, we start as an infrastructure as a service company without any silos or without any political issues within our company. We're truly trying to deliver the best infrastructure as a service solution that's on the market. So when we look at that, we actually look at, you know, what were the technical delineators that made fiber channel attractive versus Ethernet fabric solutions. And at this point, technology has converged to the point where fiber channel as a legacy protocol and speed is actually starting to completely fall off to the speed improvements such as lossless, 10 gig, now 40 gig on the Ethernet side, and then the pure flexibility you get with your storage infrastructure and your data infrastructure being collapsed onto one. And then once you remove all the political hurdles and your admins and your senior admins are actually motivated and follow sort of the same tune, we actually found it a slightly hard transition for the first 3 months, and now we will never look back. The switching fabric on the VDX side is just as stable as the old fiber channel, but it's actually faster, and it provides us a much more fluid solution when we're adding in petabytes of storage, when we're adding in constant new switches and computing infrastructure.
Why was it hard for the first couple of months?
There was a mind shift from a staffing perspective, sort of that comfort level of having your fabrics completely separated and switched. But once we truly got over sort of the mental hurdles of that collapsed infrastructure, along with sort of getting more and more comfortable with the VDX switch line, it's definitely proven to have been the correct solution.
Any specialized training that you had to do to sort of get your staff ready for it?
We definitely did the standard Brocade classes, and more importantly, though, the Brocade SE and sales team in the region actually held our hands through the first several implementations and any of the support issues. That sort of was unique to Brocade's sell methodology, and one of the reasons myself as the manager picked them as well.
So, Luke, what about virtualization? Are you guys using VMware or any other hypervisor, and what was the impact, if so, what was the impact on the network?
Sure. So Pete Colo actually is a premier service provider for VMware, and we passed that premier service provider skill set and features through our white labels. We run tens of thousands of VMs throughout our infrastructure across our data centers. From a VMware perspective, going active-active on 10 gigs, truly into a trill-based network where an absolute switch can just block out, customers wouldn't see the slightest impact, was a resiliency level and a ease of configuration level that we had always assumed would happen, but once we implemented it, it achieved our wildest dreams. Now we can do pre-configured images, slap it right on the go, fully scripted, active-active configurations out of the 10 gigs, balancing data on one and the storage on the other, then they converge in the point of a failure, and that sort of changed the game. We also run a considerable amount of Hyper-V and Citrix Xen. The Hyper-V customers would usually have 8 to 10 NICs. Now that we've been able to converge them on two 10-gig NICs as well, they've found a tremendous ease in their ability to roll out their own services and capabilities. So highly virtualized environment, very little bare metal when it comes down to it. And actually, we even like to brag our SAN's virtualized, allowing us to move our workloads around between data centers, within the data centers, within SANs of the data centers. So it's a very fluid, agile environment.
What do you use to virtualize your SANs?
Well, the SAN itself actually is a new NetApp code base called CMode, and it's essentially a complete virtualized NetApp where you can actually move it between heads and failure zones within the cluster itself.
A number of the people on today's call probably didn't have the luxury of having sort of a unified budget to a unified network. Any advice for people who are sort of thinking about trying to go through this transition but have silos that they've created over the years?
My first recommendation, Greedly, would be to look at an infrastructure as a service provider for some of that. But secondly, if you're looking at your internal organization and how you can do that, I think starting the collapsing on the one single fabric is going to be key, whether you're using the 1 gigs or the 10 gigs. So start building that fabric level infrastructure. And then once you can converge the data onto it, you'll see your cost budgets and your metrics when you're looking at the solution really start to converge and make sense. Now you're not buying discrete switches and discrete management for the data side and the storage side. So start with the fabric, then start the integration, which usually means converting your SAN itself, the Fibre Channel over Ethernet, some level of Ethernet-based product, and then you can make that migration in the time that makes the economic sense.
So Luke, a question for you. Since I, of course, you guys are pitching for people to move to an infrastructure as a service provider to either host for them or to go to your services. One of the challenges that enterprise face is how do they adopt new technology and what's the refresh cycle that they have to go on? So maybe can you talk to if a customer goes with your environment, how does your refresh cycle and the technology that you're on compare with what they would be doing in the enterprise?
Well, that's an interesting example on sort of the buy versus build scenario. And also even when you look in your own enterprise and you're matching refresh cycles, a lot of our unit-based economics are directly tied to the contracts we service with our customers. So we can actually buy and deliver our Brocade solutions on a per-port level with the Brocade BNS product line. It's their Brocade network subscription services. Furthermore, same thing on the NetApp. We're actually able to discreetly sell the storage to the refresh cycle and the term that the customer wants. And those are directly usually tied to contracts. And you can obviously tie those 1, 2, 3 to 5 year contracts depending on term and service and what you think you need from a refresh cycle. And you sort of start to abstract out the infrastructure refresh cycle to more of an app-based refresh cycle. When's that app going to need the next, you know, compute backend? Or when's that application going to start moving to Hadoop or some larger data structure that needs, you know, more and more? And now when you can tie your app to a more unit-based, you know, year, 2 year service contract for the infrastructure, I think you start to become a much more fluid and agile service. And you should look at that yourselves in your own enterprise. If you're having to buy on refresh cycles of 3 to 5 years, you're inhibiting your actual app refresh cycle to that as well. So trying to find the smaller unit economics, build smaller pods would also be my recommendation, smaller compute nodes that are tied to smaller storage systems so that you can actually refresh those on different cycles.
That's interesting. It's not the direction I expected you to go. I would have thought that you would look for a more maybe homogeneous infrastructure that you can switch out the entire infrastructure all at once.
There are actually massive complications in that. And once again, being on our fifth level of this infrastructure and at the scale we're at, we've gone through that. When your componentry gets bigger and bigger, the technical and wherewithal capability from a staffing perspective to swap out a 600 port, you know, 10 gig switch or a SAN with multiple petabytes becomes more and more complicated. So the word agile is overly used, but when you break it down, if you have smaller discrete level componentry, it's easier to swap it out. Now you also still have to overcome issues of scale, and we're able to do that once you get into that more virtualized infrastructure, even from the SAN and the switching capacity, where now we feel comfortable taking down a switch during a maintenance window and swapping it for the latest switch configuration because of the trill, because of the active-active, and because of each one of our servers discreetly plugged into those switches, so we know what impact each of those have. And as you look at an enterprise, if you can break yourself up into those smaller pods, much like we've done, you can actually set refresh cycles within those pods tied to the applications or the true services they're delivering.
I'm wondering if you've taken a look at the economics of the various approaches, and with your new consolidated network infrastructure, what kind of cost savings you've been able to deliver internally.
Or
if you can't disclose your own.
what
would a reasonable person who was going down this path expect to recover in terms of cost, or is it measured, or do you measure it some other way?
Yeah, see, what we were actually able to do for the first time is we were able to measure the actual discrete port costs of each individual switch. And once it's now collapsed and consolidated, you could say X compute node is going to use these two 10 gigabit ports on these separate switches. And those ports unit cost for me is, say, $276 a year. You're actually able to now discreetly manage that, understand that, and then deliver a solution on that. So whether you're an infrastructure as a service company that needs to monetize that and pass that on to your customer, or you're an enterprise that needs to understand what each application or service you're turning up is going to cost your organization, once you have that collapsed infrastructure, once you know what the two cables will cost, the two ports will cost, and some general administration costs, it's much smaller and a much easier realm to monetize all that. Which, once again, when you have multiple data fabrics and multiple administrators and multiple technology refresh cycles, it's far more complex. So what we were actually able to do was just figure out that unitized per unit cost and monetize it for our own solution, understand what that cost is, and now we have a much better unit economics going forward as denser solutions or newer solutions come out from Brocade.
Okay, so Luke, a two-part question for you. One is, did that change in economics impact the pricing that you gave to your customers? And secondly, do you have any tiering or quality of service or difference between your, from a network standpoint, to what you offer the users?
When we did roll out the collapsed trail-based infrastructure, the VDX line, we were able to now go from swagging the unit costs on the storage and the data side to actually having one unified cost that we're able to bundle into it, and it dramatically dropped the unit-based costs on our compute slabs that we passed to our customers. So I would say on the order of about 50% to 60%, which when you're talking tens of thousands of ports, compute nodes, data centers, it all starts to add up quite a bit. I apologize, what's the second question?
Second one is there any differentiation, or do you have different qualities of service or tiering from your networking to what you deliver to the customers, or is it just one network service across the board?
For the intra data center, it's still one network service. Lossless packet delivery on the storage side with iSCSI, near lossless with NFS, and the fact that the VDX line really isn't oversubscribed, but we're able to almost completely give it the multiple 10 gigs ports per compute node and not worry about any congested level services. So we haven't been or needed to, bluntly honest, delineate out that service. Now within a private cloud, customers can actually delineate out their services between compute nodes, between sleds, and between any of the physical equipment they may rack with us, such as delineating service for voice over IP, remote desktop protocols, etc. But overall, our SLA on the network is 100%, including the full delivery of every packet.
When you're looking at the economics, what tools are you using to measure your costs?
We have a lot of in-house tools that we've created. We also have VMware Ops Manager, some new tools that are rolling out from NetApp's perspective that we sort of correlate all together. We also use a lot of the tools from VMware to work with our white labels so that they can figure out and plug in each one of the unit economics costs and then do usage-based billing to their end users for the infrastructure componentry piece.
We should probably pause for a second and see if there are any questions out in the community. Again, *6 to unmute your line if you have a question, or you can tweet it to @Wikibon, and we'll be monitoring the questions there. Any questions? Okay. Well, we'll pick it back up and check for questions.
So Luke, here's a question for you. What can you say about customer adoption of kind of cloud infrastructure as a service? You know, where do you see things today versus, you know, maybe a year or two ago?
2 years ago, I saw small and mid-level corporations dipping their toe in infrastructure as a service where it made sense, disaster recovery, test development. And I would say in the last 18 months, especially till right now, the adoption's gone from the mid-level enterprise to the larger enterprises that on their next refresh cycle are actively looking at infrastructure as a service or cloud-based services. And what they're starting to do more times than not is actually moving productionized workloads on, because they understand it's at, in most cases, better level infrastructure than they would be able to purchase on their own unit-based economics. At the same time, they're able to still have all the same levels of controls they would have in-house, and the security concerns are really starting to get fixed and resolved by building these more privatized cloud bases, allowing their own administrative staff to meet their own HIPAA and PCI regulations, et cetera.
Okay. Maybe could you dig in a little bit on the security side as to, you know, what security do you offer and how do you compare that to what they could do in-house?
Sure. So just as an infrastructure as a service company, we don't dive into a lot of the base security components that I would normally think of. But one thing we do go above and beyond is true segmentation of each individual customer's infrastructure. So there is non-shared compute nodes, but then there is a shared storage infrastructure using the NetFC mode and delivering a virtual server or a vSAN to each individual customer. That vSAN gets put on the customer's own Trill-based VLANs that the other customers don't have, and they're able to use their own IP addressing scheme. We sort of allow for this overlap of the VLANs by building multiple Brocade VCS groups, which are the individual Trill pods, and then interconnecting those if need be through VPLS and MPLS. So it's quite complicated, but the delineation in the service allows each customer to have their own IP addressing scheme, their own VLAN scheme that they want, and still take advantage of all the unit-based economics that cloud services can give when it comes to storage and the switching fabric.
Yeah, so you know, if I think back to the traditional SAN, the Fibre Channel world, one of the things that people were a little antsy about, you know, when iSCSI first rolled out, or they look at things like NFS, was that Fibre Channel, you know, first of all, it's optical, it had a lot of physical security, and secondly, from a configuration, zoning, and management standpoint, the security was very well understood. You know, you've gone through that transition. How would you compare Fibre Channel security to the Ethernet environment that you have today?
Well, the new Ethernet environment we have today is much more robust. You're actually able to delineate out a unique SAN from a management capability, storage capability, the switching infrastructure, the IP, the VLAN per customer, and deliver that discreetly and uniquely to each one. You can also start adding LDAP or CHAP level security for authentication, NFS version 4.1 starts to get into PNFS and multiple levels of authentication and security. That is a much more robust and agile infrastructure that can be uniquely delivered to each customer, but still take advantage of the unit economics of having hundreds, if not thousands, of disks, you know, spindle speed on the back end, and terabytes of caching systems and SSD. And that's what delivers sort of each little unit having such a speed and performance. And once again, that's what we internally coin as cloud economics. That's the value and solutions that we're able to deliver.
So would you actually say that as an infrastructure as a service provider, you have, you know, a even more secure, you know, individual environment than you did, than you could deliver for Fibre Channel?
I believe right now that's absolutely the case. The NetFC mode infrastructure literally allows us to deliver a virtual discrete SAN for each one of our customers. And then that virtual discrete SAN is put on discrete VLANs and Trill-based infrastructure, allowing this whole solution to be privatized on an individual customer base. Typically on the Fibre Channel side, all you were really doing was doing worldwide naming in a zone to a couple of hard disks, et cetera. Now we're able to strike this virtual SAN across the unit economics of multiple aggregates and volumes on these SANs, delivering high IOP capability, but having a discrete management infrastructure and access infrastructure dedicated to each customer that could be unique, the passwords, the code sets, the IPs, everything. And that isn't just for us as infrastructure as a service company. That would be enterprise grade or above. It's just that it has a high hurdle to get into, and unless you're the largest multi-petabyte organization, right now that unit-based economics might be real hard. Where if you're just a company with 50 to 100 terabytes, but you want the speed as these multi-petabyte customers, that's where unit-based economics and cloud can actually start to deliver value add.
I'm curious from your perspective where the infrastructure as a service decision is being made within your target customer base. Is it happening at the CIO level, or is it happening at the infrastructure management level? And you know, who are the proponents and who are the naysayers?
Sure. So once again, in our unique business model, we do two-tier and three-tier distribution. So it would be our value-added resellers white labeling the service, adding more security services, backup, recovery, DR, the whole gamut on top of our infrastructure that are actually the ones selling. Our business development people are assisting them in this. And what we do see is the majority of the adopters are actually CIO and CFO, where they're breaking down the pure economics of the solution. They're looking at what agility or what capabilities it's going to really derive their business unit. And then you do have naysayers, we do call them the server huggers, that usually don't want to let go of just the physical construct that they can put their hands on. But once they see what the web portals, what just infrastructure as a service delivers all the same capabilities that they would have in-house, but now the ability to just grow in small unit-based chunks and the ability to grow on infrastructure that they would either not be able to afford or just couldn't afford. And then you start to bring around sort of the general IT and senior IT guys along with the CFOs and CIOs and make it a more cohesive transition strategy.
I would think your IT governance and your chief information security officers, folks like that, would have a lot of input, a lot of say into those kinds of decisions. What are you seeing from them? What are you hearing from them?
They absolutely do have a lot of input, and they're definitely a checkbox that needs to be checked off early on in your decision when looking at infrastructure as a service or looking at any shared componentry. You want to know that shared componentry, whether it's in your infrastructure, is going to meet PCI and HIPAA guidelines so that you can actually segment HR from billing, from patient services. And as an infrastructure as a service company, if you have the baseline certifications such as the SSE 16, SOC 1, PCI, all those base level certifications that say that people can grow on top of your infrastructure discreetly and securely, I think it actually makes the chief security officer's job a lot easier because now they don't have to actually get their own organization up to those certification levels. They can actually build from a solid foundation of an organization that is doing those.
So who audits your compliance then?
We have third-party auditors, we have CPA groups that audit our compliance, individual customers, and sometimes actually have us obtain certifications such as FSMA above and beyond what typically we would just go about doing.
Luke, what about orchestration? You know, how is your environment kind of plugging into the customer's environment, and you know, how does networking tie into that whole kind of cloud orchestration, if you will?
Sure. We're still working on sort of our own proprietary orchestration, and it's really just shell scripting so that we can actually log directly into the equipment, kick off the VLANs that need to be put in the main trunks, attaching the switch. And we work with our vendors to actually get the servers that are shipped that have RSAC code base on there. So as soon as it's plugged in, it kicks off a script, runs the install image right off the SAN, and gets moving and going. All that usually gets rolled up into a VMware's vCloud Director in most cases, and then we're able to actually hand the vCloud Director to the end user with all the VLANs pre-programmed through the Trill-based VDX switches, their own SAN added into vCloud Director with their own storage attached to it. And now from that simple single pane of glass interface, the majority of our customers can actually manage a complete virtual or quote-unquote software-defined data center. And you're really starting to see where the rubber meets the road on this conversion of IT as a service really coming about.
Just to reset here, we're on the phone now with Luke Norris, CEO of Infrastructure as a Service Provider of Peak Colo. And we are talking about designing a network for service provider scalability, specifically focusing on high growth and 100% uptime. I was reading an article about another colo facility that was talking about no downtime in the last 4 years. What's the sort of standard that you have for yourself?
The standard we actually have for ourselves is 100% SLA to the actual environment that's delivered to the customers. Now, that SLA does mean discrete components can fail, and that the virtual environments will recover and always be available to our end customers. And you know, if you call yourself infrastructure, you have to be as reliable as the base infrastructure, the phone infrastructure, the power, the water, the gas. And that conversion is actually starting to happen where, once again, I think with the convergence of fabrics, the convergence of storage now being IP-based, you start to have that flexibility for the failovers and the adaptation to truly start calling yourself infrastructure and infrastructure as a service.
I've got a question. This is Scott Lowe. I've got a question about the decision process, and we can step back again for just a second. When you have customers that are looking at this, other than the server huggers, what are some of the challenges and the pain points people seem to they need to overcome before they move forward with a solution like this? And when they say, no, we just can't do it right now, what are some of the reasons you're hearing for people who just can't go down this path right now?
So from a decision, very good question, thank you. So from a decision point of view, it's really sort of changing the mindset of, I have to have this vendor, or I have to have that vendor, or I have to have this solution. What you really need to change your mindset to is, I want this SLA, I want this many IOPS per second on this tier of storage, I want this uptime on my compute systems, I want this uptime on my switching systems. And once you have that SLA, and as an organization, you're comfortable with that SLA, that's the SLA you can take to market and vet with other infrastructure as a service providers. And if you can get over the mindset that my storage doesn't have to be EMC or doesn't have to be NetApp, and just pick a provider based on the SLA that they're willing to provide you and stand behind, that's a conceptual change that needs to happen. The second thing, when people just say they can't do it, it's usually an internal or political level issue that they're not willing to overcome. Point in case, they have an AS400 that can't be virtualized, or they're willing to move that to where the cloud provider's at so it can cross-connect to the cloud so that it can the cloud systems can still pull all the data from the AS400 and present it out in the new cloud units, but the need for that AS400 is still there. Is that something you're willing to relocate? Is your own internal requirements for data protection, if you need everything backed up on tape and retained, are you going to look at alternatives, say, back up on different sites and storage and retained on that storage, or do you need a tape solution? Does that infrastructure as a service provider actually provide that? So you sort of have to look at what unique processes your organization has, circle those, and then make sure the organizations, the infrastructure as a service companies you're talking to, can meet those. If there's just some that are deal breakers, throw them out there right away. Make sure that they can meet them before you get too far in the conversation. And if they can't, maybe your organization's not quite ready to do that. And the last piece we see is there's two main organizations that really benefit for this. There's ones that deliver their services out to the internet or to their own employees that are multi-locational, et cetera. Infrastructure as a service makes good sense for them because they can consolidate all that in multiple data centers, multiple cloud nodes, and distribute that. And then there's also the enterprise that maybe is near a downtown setting or sort of a corporate setting that can get high bandwidth links so that they can move those production applications, enterprise applications to the cloud, to an infrastructure as a service company, but still have the latency and resiliency that they actually need so that the screens are popping and refreshing at the speed rate the in-deliverable customer or organization is needing. If an organization just can't get that high bandwidth service yet, once again, they might be in that flux stage where it's just still not a proper solution for them.
That was actually my next question, was about bandwidth. I've kind of seen bandwidth as sort of the next great challenge that we have with the cloud, and that definitely validates that.
Once again, talk to your infrastructure as a service component, provider. Our delineation is we actually have these discrete cloud nodes in a lot of major U.S. cities, and hopefully the majority of U.S. cities by the end of next year. So now your ability to deliver low latency high bandwidth services, geolocational, say, and if you're in Colorado, directly to the Denver metro area, if you're in Seattle, you know, to downtown Seattle, so that you're driving latency down. We find it's not per se bandwidth, it's normally latency that's the killer.
Got it.
If you're in the East Coast and you're trying to connect to Amazon services on the West Coast, the latency is not going to allow you to do remote desktops. It's not going to allow you to do green screen refreshes, that kind of stuff.
Thanks.
Do you have any of the network services that you offer to the customers, or how do you bundle that networking component for what you do?
So within each one of our cloud nodes, we have at least 14 internet carriers that we do all the blended bandwidthing for our individual customers. And then using the Brocade CER line, we're able to build discrete virtual routers for each one of our customers, where if they uniquely want bandwidth forced down a particular carrier, maybe all their offices are connected on Cogent, so we'll force the bandwidth down Cogent. Maybe they have an office in India for a particular IP addressing scheme, and they want us to force the bandwidth down Tata. And that value add drives the latency down, making cloud services be able to be more enterprise quality. Further, we work with a lot of CLECs and regional providers to deliver our unique service. We have a patent-pending Layer 2 service that allows enterprises at Layer 2 to connect directly into our cloud nodes. So the concept here is you literally have a logical extension of your Ethernet fabric directly into the cloud node and then between cloud nodes. Now you can maintain your same IP addressing scheme, your same VLANs, you can ARP, you can do everything as if this cloud node was directly connected to your enterprise.
Want to open it up if there's any questions from the audience? All right, well, Luke, I've got another question for you. Where would you say, how does Peak Colo kind of differentiate themselves compared to other infrastructure as a service providers? And I guess one of the big things we're seeing is some of the big technology companies out there are also competing in the infrastructure as a software space. So not only some of the big hardware guys, but even hearing rumors about some of the big software providers that are starting to get into the space. So
absolutely.
You know, where do you see the industry today? How do you compete with it? And, you know, why don't we start with that?
Sure. Well, first off and most uniquely is our business model. We're 100% channel-driven service provider, working with other managed service providers, value-added resellers, and helping organizations make this transition to the cloud. Our customers are actually the MSPs and VARs. The VARs contract directly with the end users. And reason being is they're the ones that are the trusted advisors. They've been working with these enterprise organizations for many years. They also have the skill set to support the enterprises, support their applications, support DR recovery solutions, backup solutions, and they make a more cohesive strategy than you're ever going to get from one of the big providers. I used to work for one of them. I understood this lack of intimacy that's seen in this model. Second, a lot of the big providers are building massive cloud computing units in regions throughout America, more generated by economics of power and bandwidth. We actually drive these cloud nodes into the local Tier 2 and Tier 1 cities of America so that we can provide extremely low latency solutions so that instead of looking at moving your disaster recovery or your development environment to a cloud provider, now you can actually look at moving your enterprise services. And last, we truly have built a foundation of just infrastructure, and we've built it properly. We built it at the ability to scale the massive solutions. And we built it with providers you would trust, Brocade, NetApp. Our compute is definitely self-designed, but it follows the standards and guidelines that get support from VMware and the other vendors. So now what you're having is a trusted platform that can roll out there. And we see those three unique solutions as a major competitive difference to anybody else in the marketplace.
What are the first workloads to migrate? And what should the last one be?
First workloads to migrate should be web-centric workloads. You're going to see the most amazing value add out of those. I mean, you have right now maybe one, two, three internet carriers, and now you're able to move your website onto a sliver of SSD, solid state, off of the SAN. So now you have high availability from VMware, all running on SSD, going through 14 internet carriers. Maybe it's striked across multiple cloud nodes. Value add is going to be derived, seen there right away. And now you're able to start moving over your Tier 0, Tier 1 enterprise apps, the Oracles, the SAPs, the Exchange, into the cloud environment because you've proven the value discreetly with the web services, but now you're able to prove the value of high-speed, high IOPS storage. Now you're matching refresh rates once again on your refresh cycles from an application perspective and not worrying about storage or bandwidth, and really start driving your organization forward much faster than you would have thought.
If I go back to my days in IT, I remember a time when we brought on I was with a bank, we brought on a new customer, and it just happened to be one of the 10 largest companies in the U.S. with, 300,000 to 400,000 users, and it absolutely crushed us the day we turned them live. You know, what kind of scaling can you handle both from a compute, network, storage perspective? How fast can you scale up?
You know, and once again, here's the delineator between your fiber channel-based SANs and a true cluster-based storage network and a true converged Ethernet fabric. We're able to inject 10, 20 Ethernet-level switches with Trill non-disruptively right into the fabric, attach hundreds if not thousands of compute nodes into those switches, and we can add up to 20, 30, 40 petabytes into our cluster-based NetApp system. And literally, because the NetApp systems are virtualized, we can balance out the workloads, moving those virtual SANs to different compute heads, to different aggregates and RAID groups, balancing that out. And that's the literal agility that you need when you're an infrastructure as a service component, or when you're a large enterprise having to randomly adapt to new workloads or applications. We've just taken that to an infinite level scale and said, you know, how do you add 10 switches to a network non-disruptively? How do you add 2 petabytes and 10,000 VDIs that need to be turned up tomorrow into an environment and make it so that, A, you don't have a noisy neighbor effect affecting the other people on that particular unit, and B, just the raw agility to be able to expand to that. And once you have that converged fabric and that virtualized SAN, I think you've actually hit a sweet spot that makes your life a lot easier.
You know, a couple of times, several times on today's call, you have mentioned SSDs and the impact on performance. There's also a notion, though, that you need to have a balanced system. And when you put microsecond response time into millisecond networks and things like that, does it create any special challenges for you as a service provider?
You've hit the nail on the head on a couple of things. We do use a lot of SSD. In fact, all of our compute nodes only have SSD. There's no moving parts in the compute nodes. And in the SAN, we're able to build out large-scale SSD systems and sell those as little slivers of, say, 100 gigs to the end user. Reason being is what you'll find with SSD and SAN is the ability to drive massive parallel IOPS, where you might have one virtual desktop image that you want to have cloned 500 times and running actively. Or you might have a small scientific amount of data that you need multiple physical servers computing and crunching on. But you can't copy that data because you don't want to fear that there'd be any integrity level issues. And those are all great use cases for SSD on a SAN, because you're correct, there is still sub-millisecond but high millisecond latency through the fiber channel, not the fiber channel, the VDX level infrastructure, the Trill, into the SAN and then back out. We do have a mix of also Fusion IO and some of our compute nodes where a customer just truly needs, you know, .300 nanoseconds or something to that solution of delivery where they're moving small workloads in and out, but they need to do it extremely fast. So we work with our customers to try to find the solution. I'm also excited to what I see in the convergence on server-level storage being replicated back to SAN storage fluidly and at a driver level in the hypervisor, and I'm really excited to see what solutions come out in the next year.
So Luke, could you explain a little bit more of your flash environment? So you've got, you know, SSD or sometimes Fusion IO in the server. Are you running flash in the NetApp, or is there some other kind of network-based flash that you have, and how do you manage flow between all of those different pieces, or is that something that you just statically set?
So you are correct. Our NetApps all do have what's called the flash cache technology, and that is where deduplicated data is put onto the solid state, and then non-random reads would come from that. Further, we're also experimenting with their latest technology, Flash Pools, and that is where you integrate SSD drives into the disk aggregates. So writes now, instead of going to the NVRAM on a head, actually flush to the SSD and then flush over to disk as needed. And once again, they also can take care of non-random reads by doing seeding and other solutions. And then you have a third tier, which is just true SSD in and out of the NetApp heads. And then a fourth tier, which right now is the Fusion I.O. cards in the host-based system. So it's really working with our end users and the VARs, and this is where the VAR's value really starts to come into play, and understanding that application the customer is running, where is it going to be better balanced? Is it pure SSD? Is it some mix of SAS drives with the flash cache in the NetApp SAN? Or is it just something that needs to be Fusion I.O. because you're moving, say, 1 kilobit or 2 kilobit blocks in and out very fast instead of larger 4 kilobit and 16 gigabit chunks, which would look better on the storage infrastructure? And last, you need to start looking at the future and what scalability brings. The flash cache is great, but that's tied to an actual head, where the flash pool technology is SSDs tied to an aggregate, and those move between heads. And now when you have a virtual SAN that you can balance not only between heads, but between multiple heads or between different, you know, HA clusters within your cluster, you have to look at how is that impact going to be. And if you've sat there and deduplicated your data and seeded a flash cache, and now you've moved that volume to, say, a completely different HA pair, completely different head, none of that data there is in flash cache. So now it's imperative you look at new technologies such as flash pools, or just if the customer needs that level of speed, what the agility and fluidity for us to balance them out, maybe they just need to be on SSD. And as an infrastructure as a service company, it's our duty to constantly be looking at the metrics of load and balance those out and have an infrastructure that can handle it. The switching infrastructure can't be overrun if you actually have somebody pushing 10 gigs. It's got to have a very low overhead from latency. And when we looked at the VDX infrastructure, the silicon actually in it moves packets in and out of the switch faster on the Ethernet side than they do even on their fiber channel side. So it's constantly looking at these 40, 50 metrics and understanding how to balance out your infrastructure and continue to scale it at, you know, massive, massive levels.
The other thing that's been discussed an awful lot lately is big data, and so I'm curious if you're seeing companies who are trying to do big data analytics moving them to a hosted infrastructure as a service provider. Is that a logical workload to move?
I think that's probably one of the biggest value-add workloads to move to an infrastructure as a service provider. Point in case, your big data set might be a petabyte or 2 petabytes now, and it might be 8 petabytes 2 years from now. You can do smaller discrete level contracts with infrastructure as a service providers, allowing you to have that agility to just sort of buy what you need right now when you need it. If you're a company doing those big data workloads, you're having to buy at your sort of peak usage levels. You're having to buy at what you anticipate your growth will be in a couple of years. Where with infrastructure as a service, you're able to buy just in the units as you expand out, or possibly even shrink in some cases. Further, you're able to take advantage of usually a much larger parallelization, many more spindles, a much more robust infrastructure componentry, and a much more baked solution. We find a lot of our big data customers are usually more concerned about the analytics of their data, moving their data in and out, than they need to be on the infrastructure side. So once we take that infrastructure off of them, provide them a quality service, they're able to focus on the actual end deliverable, which is getting that analytics out of that data.
Let me take another second here and just open it up, see if there are any other questions from any of today's participants. Again, star 6 to unmute your line.
So, Luke, wonder if you could, if you've done any quantification of power. You know, let's start with the network piece, but you know, things like flash, I'm sure, are affecting this. You know, what's your power environment, and do you have a metric that you measure kind of your density of your environment and your power efficiency?
Yeah. So we actually do go through provider data centers that usually are white labeling our solution as part of our partner network. Power is a very large unit economic of ours. So what you find is, you know, when we're looking at the brocade switches and we're looking at 10 base T providers, the 10 base T ports were actually using much more power than the individual SFP Plus, especially with the TwinX cables, et cetera. So we're able to derive a much lower power load with that switching infrastructure. And that's actually very important because with the compute density we're at, we're already at about anywhere between 9 to about 18 kilowatts of actual used power in a particular rack. And at a 2N level, we're almost having to deliver 40 kilowatts to these racks with the density that we're driving our compute stuff. So literally every little watt we look at when it comes to the compute node or the switching infrastructure. And now on the storage infrastructure.
Sorry, Luke, so just so I heard you right. Inside the rack, you're still using SSD Plus, and you know, part of that is the expectation is 10G base key will come down in power over time, but definitely today on a per port basis. It's more power. SFP Plus, of course, you're limited to only a couple of meters that you can run. As opposed to 10G base T, you can go a little bit further, and optical, you can go even further.
That's correct. So using the SFP Plus cables, and also as a service provider or a very large enterprise, your density levels within these racks is pretty immense. We stick about 240 discrete compute nodes, each with dual 10 gig cards in them, within a rack. So now you're not talking about top of rack switch. You're talking a top of rack switch, a middle of rack switch, another middle of rack switch, and a bottom of rack switch. And usually a switch to each side of that, which are in compute racks, network racks, to finish off the full redundancy and availability in these racks. Mm-hmm. And that's the level when you're putting so much compute and so much switching in a rack, you literally have to worry about every watt you put in there, because having to drop another power whip and PDUs and everything on there, in some cases, isn't either feasible, or you just can't put that much density from a watt load, a heat load, on the server floor room.
So it sounds like, do you know how many switches do you have, and what kind of scale are you up to?
It varies.
Ports, yeah.
It varies between our data center. Our densest single rack has 4 60-port switches in it. To keep up with all the compute we have in there. We typically have multiple VCS groups. So a VDX line has a VCS group that would be one trill-based pod. And we have to do multiples of these because of the VLAN overlaps and IP issues we spoke about. I'd say our largest one has maybe 16 to 20 VDX switches. But like I said, we have 5 data centers currently throughout the country. I'd have to talk to one of the more network engineers on that.
What disaster recovery has been a focus on a number of our peer insights, and I'm curious what you're providing in terms of disaster recovery services across the multiple data centers. Are you replicating data? If so, what are you using?
So that's also part of our unique business model. We're just the infrastructure as a service component. The value-added resource servers and the managed service providers are really tiering on their layers above that. We've seen everything from VMware SRM, which we can license a la carte on a per VM basis, to Zerto, to Veeam, to also using some NetApp product sets. What's complicated is because our code sets and our features are usually well above standard enterprises, it's very hard for enterprises to replicate their enterprise into our environments unless they do it at a software tier, a Zerto or a Veeam type solution. Now, actually, what we're really excited about is a lot of the higher tier storage vendors and software vendors are actually building VMware level appliances. So you'll see something roll out from NetApp called ONTAP Edge, where it's an actual VMware appliance that looks and runs and smells like a NetApp SAN. And now we can start doing things like SnapMirror and SnapCopy from enterprises into our data centers for DR and test dev environments. And then last, the real value we provide is between all of our cloud nodes and the enterprises we connect to is that layer 2 meshing technology. So you can literally drag and drop your workloads between our cloud nodes and your enterprise, either doing storage vMotion or just pausing it and just pure replicating and copying it. And the ability to turn it on, have it use the same resources between the sites to test validation, to test DR, it's a game changer in this environment. And it allows you actually to start using some of your DR for also quote-unquote mixed workload productions. Maybe you actually move some of your production workload to your DR facility on the fly, test it, run it there, see if you have any level of problems a couple times a year. So now you're not just replicating your data, you're actually truly testing it.
So Luke, it sounds like, you know, it's like many other service providers, you guys are kind of pushing the envelope, trying the new technologies. You know, where do you have a need in the vendor community? What are you pushing them on? What do you need to be able to kind of enhance your model going forward?
more software-defined networking is really going to continue to enhance the service and delivery we have. There's been some great moves by VMware by Nicira. VMware is also going to have a VXLAN integrated into their next virtualization switches. But that all works and looks great in pure virtual environments. The need for enterprises to still have mixed workloads with physical level environments cross-connected into the cloud, or their enterprises cross-connected in the cloud, is paramountly important. So now we have to extend all those neat features that are in software-defined networking in the virtual environment back through the physical level environment to really make this sort of a homogeneous solution that can be delivered. So we're pushing our vendors quite actively on that. Brocade has actually gone to great lengths and levels working with us on those solutions. They have them laid out in roadmaps, and we're actively testing with them. We also need the whole idea of sort of the software-defined data center to continue to get strides. Constant sort of single API sources, the ability to have one place to write code in and get data out, that's eventually going to be sort of paramount as we start to move forward, because there's so much information being generated by all these systems, and there's so much command level and scripting capabilities. But if you have to discreetely write each one of them, and then the next version of code or the next service release or the next vendor you pick, you have to start all over, those start becoming barriers to entry. So we're trying to figure out, you know, what common API systems we can get out there, common language we can get out there, and really start driving the whole idea of software-defined data centers and software-defined networking forward.
Yeah, just want to check one last time before we wrap up today. Scott, appreciate your question. Do you have any follow-up questions? Anyone else? Star 6 to unmute. Okay, well, with that, I think we'll wrap up today's call. Again, this is John MacArthur, Peer Insight Moderator with Stu Miniman. We're joined today by Luke Norris, CEO of Infrastructure as a Service Provider, Pete Colo. Luke, we really appreciate your time today coming on with us.
Quick question, Luke, if people want to find more about Pete Colo, where do we find you? Are you going to be presenting at VMworld, or you know, where can we learn a little bit more about Pete Colo?
Of course, you can go to our website, www.pcolo.com. There's not a tremendous amount of information there because we are in that two-tier, three-tier distribution model. Our partners such as NetApp and Brocade have great videos and solution papers on us. And I will be presenting on Tuesday's Super Session with the founder of NetApp, Dave Hitz, talking about the virtualized data center and how the new C-Mode virtualized SAN is really providing the agility we need in our environments and the scalability we need.
Great.
Oh, and I will also be at the NetApp booth on Tuesday and Wednesday, sort of fielding calls and working with them on that. So there'll be people wearing Pete Colo shirts, I'm sure, all around there. So feel free to drop by and say hi to somebody.
Luke, again, thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us today. Just as a reminder, we will have 6 research notes up on Wikibon within the next 48 hours. And thank you for joining us today, and keep watching the Peer Insights page on wikibon.org for upcoming Peer Insights. Hope to see many of you at VMworld. Take care, and thanks very much.
Thanks, everyone.